You're with John Cleary on ABC Local Radio and on Radio Australia.
Thank you for joining us. Bishop Tom Frame, known to many Australians as the former Bishop of the Australian Defence Forces. Most recently an author on various books. His most recent release is Children on Demand, The Ethics of Defying Nature. Among other things, Tom Frame talks to us about commodifying kids and fertility. Tom Frame will join us in just a few moments. After Tom Frame, we'll hear from you in the Inquisition, if you want to play the game. Then a postcard with Noel Debien, some music in the chat room with Christabel Chamaret. But right now, by way of introduction to Bishop Tom Frame, his Supertramp, Logical Song.
When I was young, it seemed that life was so wonderful.
Supertramp, Logical Song, from a 70s album, Breakfast in America. You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio around Australia. John Cleary with you. The music is a selection of our guest. Somebody you got to know is the Bishop to the Defence Forces of Australia, Bishop Tom Frame, now the Professor of Theology at Charles Sturt University. Tom Frame's a prolific author, and his latest offering is Children on Demand, The Ethics of Defying Nature. Tom Frame, welcome to the program.
Good evening, John.
Tom Frame, in writing a book such as this, you're taking on one of the hot-button issues for society. I guess we should say at the outset what you're not doing. You're not getting into the debate over stem cells. You're going back a step before that into a debate that many people think is settled. That's the whole issue of children and fertility. It's a step back from what is rapidly becoming a very, very contested area. I guess what you're saying is, hang on here, folks, there's actually a few basic things we have to consider.
Oh, that's right, John. I mean, one of the things that I grew up with was an infertile father. And certainly it is the case that more people are dealing with infertility in Australia as each year goes by. And as people try to overcome infertility, there's also a view, I think rising in stature, that people are somehow entitled to have children and they should be entitled to have them by whatever means are available, and that you and I, the taxpayer, should be paying for them.
You take us on a rather long journey in this book, and I'd like to get into the details of it shortly. But you mentioned there you have an infertile father, but there's more to your personal journey than that as well. Just tell us a little about the way you grew up and the family structure you had, because so much of this book surrounds broadly the definitional questions that spring off family.
Oh, indeed they do. And perhaps that's why I've always been drawn to that Supertramp song, which is that we try to make some logical sense of our lives, but there are so many things that just don't make sense to us at all. There's parts of us that come from within we don't understand, and there are institutions that sometimes we find ourselves within, and they can make life far more complex and even chaos than we thought they might have done. I mean, for me, I was the child of a 16-year-old woman who, I suppose we'd say, made a mistake, was pregnant unexpectedly, and she wasn't able to care for me. My adopted parents, they had been married some 15 years before I was conceived, and in the early 1960s they made an application for a child, and at the end of 1962 the child that they were offered was me. So I grew up with a father who struggled very, very much with being an infertile man. To him, fertility and manhood went together. And when he found himself to be infertile, I think that very largely led to his descent into alcoholism. So on the one hand, I was the child he'd always wanted, but on the other, I represented the child that he could never have. Mm-hmm. And so, as happens with alcoholics, people are drawn into the turmoil of their lives. He became violent, and I grew up with domestic violence almost as an everyday occurrence as a child, and that's pretty frightening.
Mm. You write with an appreciation, as you've just displayed, of the pain of infertility. Yet you're saying, as a major thrust of your book, that pain and the attempts to deal with it can be the source of even greater pain. That unless we deal with the arguments that result out of that pain and our attitudes to infertility, we risk creating greater ethical dilemmas, and those dilemmas are going to be passed down through generations.
Yes, that's certainly my view. What I'm concerned about, first of all, is that people who do face infertility, that they're under so much pressure from many members of their family and even society, that they ought to have children. Somehow their lives will be complete, their purpose will be fulfilled if they have children. And I would want to challenge that. I mean, there has always been a tradition in the kind of society that we live in, that there's almost a calling to singleness, that there are some things you can do as a single person that you can't do as a married person or as a fertile person with children. So I'd want to address that in the first instance. But then when we go beyond that, there are some ways of dealing with infertility, as you've suggested, which create problems. Things like surrogacy, things like artificial insemination by donor, IVF. There are many, many issues which seem to me arising from our attempts to deal with infertility, if you like, to defy nature. So what we do find is that children are now growing up with very, very complicated parenting situations.
Couple of things I'd like to talk about in a minute. One is the line you used there, defying nature. But first, let's talk about the nature of the family and children, because most of us have got used to the idea that, like all things in society, in an age of technological change, definitions change, that what we once viewed as a certain way, we've got to get used, because of technology, because of the pace of change, of we've got to view in a slightly different way. We've got to be prepared, for example, to allow what we understand a family is and was to change. You're suggesting that may be true, but let's be very careful and let's understand what we're talking about here.
No, that's certainly right, and it's particularly applying to children. I mean, there's a sense of simplicity about having a mother and father, and if they're together in the same house and do provide complementary care, then the children don't have too complicated, arrangements from which they receive care from adults. If, though, for instance, we talk about surrogacy just quickly, it is possible for a surrogate child to have five parents. It could have the commissioning couple. It could then have the surrogate mother. It could then have provider of sperm and an egg. And what we find very quickly is that, and we know this from experience of children in blended families, if one set of relationships are not working out, then people think, well, inevitably another will be better than this because they're more natural, they're more real, they're what someone perhaps prefers. So we do have many, many complications arising in parenting arrangements now because of technology. But we ought to be very careful. In my own view, and it's even been my experience with a violent alcoholic father, that the complementary care of a man and a woman has much to be said for it. If we are to have an arrangement that is other than that, we need to be very, very sure that we're not damaging, harming, disadvantaging children along the way.
You're touching here on something that the Australian-born ethicist, now resident in Canada, Margaret Somerville, raised when she was here in Australia last year for the Sydney Writers' Festival. In speaking of this whole area, she said we should bear in mind something that the Green Movement actually articulates very well, and that's the precautionary principle. Can you just expound that a little for us?
Yes. If you propose to do something other than, say, if we're talking here about reproduction, that something other than what nature provides, and nature still dictates that we need a man and a woman to produce a child, if you are going to do something different, then you ought to have a particularly good reason or certainly a sufficient data for us to do things differently that it's not going to cause unexpected consequences or unintended harm. We ought to be very, very cautious about doing things differently than we have always done them if we are unsure about all of the range of effects of doing just that. Now, that's not to say that we ought to be hidebound and traditionalist and never do anything new, but when it does come to children, and children have been brought into the world over thousands and thousands upon years, then if we are going to do things differently, let's be careful. Now, we know that children, John, are brought into the world, say sometimes where one of the parents, well, mainly it'll be the father, the mother could, have a car accident and be kept alive until the child is brought to birth. But if children are brought into the world without one parent, we know that one already has a larger burden, we'd certainly think, I still think, that two parents are better than one in terms of sharing the load. So they're the kind of precautions that we ought to bear in mind if we do things different than, in this case, nature would seem to dictate.
Let's just push that boundary a little. Nature dictating seems to imply that nature has a will. You're not making, though, a theological argument here, are you?
No, I'm almost tempted to, but I can't bring myself just to do it. I've toyed with the idea because there are some things plainly that we do which are contrary to nature, or things that we do, we intervene in nature. I mean, there are some people, for instance, who would die, except that we intervene by medical cures and we have medicines and prescriptions and things like that, and we're able to keep people alive. And you'd say, well, if you are going to interfere with nature or defy nature, then you shouldn't do that. So that's why at this stage I'm only able to go in my own thinking to say that a man and a woman is required to produce a child, and maybe there's a certain logic in that. Certainly that's been our experience, and I think people who have grown up with one parent rather than two would say, look, they did get different things from a man and a woman. They learnt different things about being a boy or a girl, and that's important, and they would not want to give that away.
Well, before we get into that argument about sexual ethics and those sorts of things, let's talk about the children for a moment and the application of the precautionary principle here, because we're talking about a situation, as you outline, in which the problem with the issue is when you get a couple deciding for whatever reason that they want kids or they want treatment for infertility or whatever the circumstances is, you're dealing with a one party in that discussion who has no voice. That's the unborn child. So they cannot exercise their rights in the situation. So the precautionary principle has added weight here because we're actually taking precautions on the behalf of someone who as yet has no voice in the situation and whose life will be profoundly affected by the decisions that are made.
Yes, children are wonderfully malleable and they're able to accept and accommodate all sorts of things. But that ought not either to be taken for granted or exploited. That's why I've suggested, and I don't want legislation to intrude on these kind of matters, but there's an element of which I would like to see the public, perhaps expressed in terms of the state, having a sense of responsibility, overriding responsibility for all human life that in the end, if both the parents are killed, the state may have some burden of responsibility of care for that particular child. But I would want at least the state to be saying, well, you know, the parents, the man, the woman, they want certain things. But what would a child want or reasonably ask for or expect in a certain situation? And for that, I think with that particular mindset, I do think we ought to have people who are advocates for unborn children, children who are not yet going to come into existence. Now, they will accept the circumstances in which they find themselves. But I suppose what we don't want is a situation we've seen in America in a litigious culture where some children have felt they want to divorce their parents or sue them for wrongful birth and terrible things like that where everyone is just going to get hurt.
Let's lay out a few of the things here that are potential dangers facing the unborn child who has no choice in the situation of the circumstances of their birth. You mentioned litigious children, but it raises a whole lot of issues for kids coming out of a marital situation which may not be the conventional mum and dad situation, areas in which research has not yet been able to determine outcomes for us. It takes us, for example, into the nature versus nurture debate. That is, to what extent are kids genetically determined? To what extent are they environmentally determined? Is there any research to say what family structures in various forms will do for various kids? You open this up to some larger degree.
Yes, I do. But I have to say that in terms of the new family structures that we're seeing brought about by technology, these really just early days. We're still getting a bit of a handle on whether or not children are affected at all. Now, there is an element in some of the research that I've seen that says that in terms of a range of developmental factors, children don't seem to be disadvantaged. They're doing well as other children. What I'm concerned about is what happens when some of those children born by AID, IVF, surrogacy or some other mechanism, that when they're teenagers or when they're in their 20s, for me, all those questions about who am I, where did I come from, why am I like the kind of person that I am, those actually became more acute when I was a teenager and in my 20s, those big existential questions, not when I was a little child where, if you like, I could perform at school and I didn't do too badly. But it was later on in life that that became more important. And we're just moving now into a phase where there are a sufficient number of children, say who are born with donor sperm through IVF, that they're now in a situation of saying, I'd like to know who my donor is because there's one part of the mosaic that is me that is missing and I can't make sense of the picture.
And there are very good reasons why a child may need to know who their donor was, given the evolution, rapid evolution, of genetic technology.
Look, absolutely. I mean, the thing, going right back, what concerned me and why I started to think about these questions is when I was training for the Anglican ministry, I went to work at Royal North Shore Hospital and I met a young man there who had a neurological wasting disease in his lower arms. And I asked him about it and he said that his life was kind of falling apart because, believe it or not, he was a tree surgeon and his hobby was riding motorcycles, neither of which he could do because the poor man's lower arms lack muscle tone. And what he said to me was that if they'd known that I had this condition, they could have stopped me losing some of the muscle tone. And I said, well, why didn't they know? He said, I was adopted. He said, I didn't have that information about my medical past. And then it made me think, of course, about my own two children. I had two daughters by then. And I thought, goodness me, I wonder what I have passed on to them quite unknowingly. And perhaps I do need to go and find members further up my family tree so that I can take that information and perhaps look at my daughters. And if there's certain things I observe, medical conditions or problems they might have, I can say, well, it might be this or it might be that. Now, of course, it might be absolutely nothing. But at least if you do have knowledge of those biologically to whom you're related, you have some capacity to know from your medical history what you might be facing in life.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio Around Australia. John Cleary with you. My guest, Tom Frame, former Bishop to the Defence Forces of Australia and now Professor of Theology at Charles Sturt University. We're talking about Tom Frame's new book, Children on Demand, The Ethics of Defying Nature. Are we rushing headlong into a future of which we have paid too little attention, particularly when it comes to children. Let's have another piece of music, Tom Frame. Harry Chapin, long a favourite of many, A Life Cut Short, Cats in the Cradle. Why'd you pick this?
Well, since the last time we've spoken, I've become a grandfather. And I
congratulations.
Have say, thank you.
A very young grandfather, we might say. A youthful grandfather, indeed.
At 45, a grandfather. And I have to say, look, it really is wonderful, because I remember when we had our own children, my grandmother saying, oh, look, you know, it's great when you can kind of hand them back. And we're having that experience now. But it's made me think about the things that I did as a parent, which I'm now observing in my daughter, and asking some of those kind of questions that get asked in this song.
My child arrived just the other day. He came to the world in the usual way, but there were planes to catch and bills to pay. He learned to walk while I was away, and he was talking for I knew it. And as he grew, he'd say, I'm gonna be like you, Dad. You know I'm gonna be like you. And the cat's in the cradle and the silver spoon, little boy blue and the man on the moon. When you're coming home, Dad, I don't know. Turned 10 just the other day. He said, thanks for the ball, Dad. Come on, let's play. Can you teach me to throw? I said, not today. I got a lot to do. He said, that's okay. And he walked away, but his smile never dimmed. Said, I'm gonna be like him. Yeah, you know I'm gonna be like him. And the cat's in the cradle and the silver spoon, the little boy blue and the man on the moon. When you're coming home, I don't know when, but we'll get together then. You know we'll have a good time then. Well, he came from college just the other day. So much like a man, I just had to say, son, I'm proud of you. Can you sit for a while? He shook his head and he said with a smile, what I'd really like, Dad, is to borrow the car keys. See you later, can I have them, please? And the cat's in the cradle and the silver spoon, little boy blue and the man on the moon. When you're coming home, son, I don't know when, but we'll get together then, Dad. You know we'll have a good time then. Since retired, my son's moved away. I called him up just the other day. I said, I'd like to see you if you don't mind. He said, I'd love to, Dad, if I can find the time. You see, my new job's a hassle and the kids are the flu. But it's sure nice talking to you, Dad. It's been sure nice talking to you. And as I hung up the phone, it occurred to me, he'd grown up just like me. My boy was just like me. And the cat's in the cradle and the silver spoon, little boy blue and the man on the moon. When you're coming home, son, I don't know when, but we'll get together then, Dad. We're gonna have a good time then.
Cats in the Cradle, Harry Chapin, a selection of our guest, Tom Frame, former Bishop to the Defence Forces of Australia and now Professor of Theology at Charles Sturt University. On Sunday night, Tom Frame is the author of Children on Demand, The Ethics of Defying Nature. Tom Frame, let's talk about a couple of the specific issues. First, Children on Demand implies that we're really entering into an age where, because the way technology works, we can actually treat fertility as a sort of consumer choice, so that it risks commodification of children, that children cease to be lives with ethics and rights, but objects which we can choose to have or not have, to possess or not possess, and to drop into any situation which we feel suits us.
John, there are certainly people who believe that a child is a right that they have. And if it is a right, then the state ought to assist them to satisfy that right. And there are people, and certainly my experience in working with a hospital fertility clinic, people who say that it doesn't matter what age they are, it doesn't matter what circumstances they're in, they have a right to a child and they must be assisted. Now, we know that reproductive technology is very expensive. It also is a burden for those who are part of it. I mean, we know that women suffer. We know that there's all sorts of emotional stresses and strains when it comes to overcoming infertility by technological means. And I think there are times at which I think to myself, look, you don't have a right to children. And if we talk about children as a right, we overlook the fact that they are a wonderful gift, and I see them as a form of blessing. And I would want to say thank you. As a Christian, I'd say thank you to God for the child, but certainly thank you to nature that we can be custodians of life by bringing life into being and then have responsibility for nurturing a child into adulthood.
Another issue you raise is the nature of parenting, particularly when it comes to the roles of mums and dads. And you've touched on that briefly, but let's talk about that in a little more detail. Particularly for fatherhood, one of the things you hint at, you just introduce us to the argument. You don't pull it right through and you don't lay down the law, but you do say, well, look, if you take a situation in which fathers are simply the deliverers of sperm and not necessary to the healthy development of the child, that is, you can have a lesbian couple perhaps bringing up a child, that really not only says something, you're making a judgment there about nurturing, what's required in nurturing a child, but you're also making a judgment about the status of the male in society, which can have unintended consequences as well. That is, you are saying that masculinity is unnecessary, and we're not in a position to know that yet.
No, I think that's very much the case. I mean, I temper my remarks by saying, you know, I grew up with a father who didn't cope well with infertility and drank and was violent. And yet, John, there were some things that my father gave to me that my mother could never give to me. He taught me some male virtues. He taught me to respect women, although ironically he hit my mother when he was drunk. He taught me about teamwork. He taught me about truthfulness. There were some things that he taught me in such a way that I could hear them because he was another male. There were some things that my mother taught me, of which perhaps the most enduring, I think, effects of those are fidelity and steadfastness and things like that. Certainly, I learnt different things in different ways from my parents. Now, I'm not wanting to universalise the particular, but we learn in different ways from different people. And if we don't think that men are important to our society, then what we do, I think, is affect both boys and girls because their fathers relate to them differently. I know as a father of two daughters and now of a grandfather of one granddaughter that there's the kind of things that I need to say to them and the kind of things they look for me to say to them that will make a difference. My wife can say certain things to our daughters and to our grandchild, but if I say certain things as a man, it means different things. Now, saying what those things are and trying to say they apply in all cases would be foolish because these things are obviously expressed in relationships which are going to have all different kinds of characters. But I still want to insist that men have something to say to human beings, understanding that humanity has male and female components and that we need each other to understand the totality of which we are a part.
And you're saying something there both about nature and about nurture. That is that millions of years of biological evolution and certainly hundreds of thousands of years of cultural evolution have carried that as a sustaining model, and we junk it in a generation at our peril.
Yes, I don't see why we should be the first generation to say that men or women don't matter. Why should we do that? What gives us any more entitlement, and certainly on what basis are we going to argue that somehow we can just put aside men or women? In other words, that...
But it's not an argument you're mounting in terms of rights, are you? You're mounting that argument in terms of, as I said earlier, the precautionary principle.
Oh, no, that's right. Look, yes. I'm not wanting to say in this book, although I think some people would want me to, I'm not saying anything about same-sex relationships. I'm saying something about the nurture of children and the requirement for the complementary care that we're only beginning just now to understand. Now, I've not pressed the argument, as you said, on a couple of instances, as hard as I might, because we're only now just understanding the nature of the complementarity of care that men and women bring. But we really have to be very careful if we are saying men don't matter. And when I hear people say in a lesbian relationship that they will have significant male others, well, that to my mind isn't good enough. I had my dad, and my dad had all his faults, but he is my dad. Now, I've never met my biological father, and you know, John, that still matters to me at 45. I still imagine what he might be like. I still think about what kind of effect would he have on my life if I were to know him.
And does it concern you genetically as well?
I suppose it less so now because my daughters have good health and my little granddaughter, she seems to be fine. But there are things, I suppose, as I get older, maybe too as you get older, you don't want to know, because if there is something in the family that has a somewhat perilous
yes, effect. If the time bomb is ticking, it's getting closer.
Oh, that's right. Look, I've met people who have said, look, we have this condition in the family. I'm never going to be genetically tested for it because I don't want to know. I mean, they know they're going to die, but they don't want to know of what. And I do think that, the shadow of something imminent or something awful, we actually would prefer to live in ignorance of those things.
Let's talk about the other topic you just touched on in gay relationships. We've come in a society to a position where we say, look, just as nature versus nurture is at issue when it comes to parenting of kids, so nature versus nurture is at an issue in determining sexual preference, and that we really can't afford to be too judgmental on this. We need to accept that people do have sexual preferences, which can be gay or hetero, and allow people to function as family in that situation. But you go that far, but you then say, but once again, you hit the issue of children. The nature of that discussion needs to change. Why?
Well, I think we've not yet seen that gay coupling and parenting is not without some of the complications that we might, on the face of it, imagine there exists. In other words, we live in a society where there is not a society that is not without discrimination against gay couples and gay people. Now, while that is the case, then the child has already got, if you like, an added burden which it needs to carry through life, because when it's dropped off at school with two mothers or two fathers, playgrounds are brutal and sometimes unrelenting places. And that child already, not having had direct contact with a parent of one particular gender, then has to deal with that. There'll be all sorts of questions that they will need to face specifically because they're brought up in that particular relationship. But as you were hinting, my concern is about the child not having a mother or a father, which would impart to that child some particular things. It's not much more than that. But I do think that in terms of the evidence, I'm wanting to see the evidence that children are okay. If children are okay in those situations in longitudinal studies and we see that, then one of my concerns would then evaporate.
Mm. And the issue of longitudinal studies is seriously longitudinal. Like, we're talking about generational studies here, not just the first 7 years.
Well, I would have thought so, because you know, we're parents and we're children until we die. I mean, I'm still a child of my parents. They're no longer on earth, but the effects of their parenting are still with me. I still relate to them through my memories of them in a particular way. So we go through life always being children, and for some of us also being parents. And you know, I think having a couple of generations to see how this plays out. Now, I'm willing to let these things play out and not to prohibit things with law. What I would, though, ask is that we act prudently, and that people who think, well, I might do this, then perhaps hearing about some of these other concerns might then be more cautious and might be more conscious of what they are creating for a child that they want to bring into being.
Let's talk about one other of the hot-button issues here, and that's gay adoption. Is it not better for a child to be brought up by a gay couple rather than in the isolation of state care, being a state ward and having no real significant others?
Yes, I must say that I'm heading in that direction, that I would not want, and our society does not want, children to be in long-term institutional care. There needs to be someone that they can cuddle and someone who can cuddle them. There needs to be talk of love. That can't happen in institutions because people know, and particularly when it comes to children, they will sense that the care that they get is contractual care. I mean, the people genuinely care in these institutions, but they're not meant to love these children. They're not meant to show them the kind of affection that you get in families. So if the alternative is for children in institutional care, that there is no alternative but to have a same-sex couple adopt them and care for them, then how could anyone object? How could anyone object on the basis that the child's best interests were served in it staying in institutional care? Now, having a little bit of a tussle about what is in the child's best interests, I think, is something also that we could deal with. But my feeling about it is, and what I have certainly seen in a number of institutions, is I would rather children be in the community with a couple who love them. And the arrangement might be complicated, but I think that's better than them staying in a place where essentially no one loves them.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio Around Australia. John Cleary with you. My guest, Tom Frame, former bishop to the Defence Forces and now professor of theology at Charles Sturt University, author of Children on Demand, The Ethics of Defying Nature. A call to slow down and have a little bit of a think about the whole issue of rapid change in practices surrounding fertility. Tom Frame, another piece of music. Joan Osborne, One of Us. Tell us a little about this selection.
Well, I have to say, when that song came out a few years ago, it was an absolute preacher's dream, because one of the things that people certainly asked me as a member of the clergy is, you know, what is God like and how can you know? And if God created this world, then people didn't think much of God because they saw the world, you know, red in tooth and claw, violent, bloodthirsty, unrelenting, sometimes unjust. And for me, the song was interesting because it really got a debate going amongst people that I was mixing with, and particularly younger people. You know, what if God was one of us, just like us, a slob on a bus? So in terms of a preacher, in terms of the kind of dialogue that people want to have, that song was a perfect intro.
What if God was one of us?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. What if God was? except for the Pope may be in Rome.
What if God were one of us? Joan Osborne on Sunday night on ABC Radio around Australia. John Cleary with you, my guest. Tom Frame, author of Children on Demand, The Ethics of Defying Nature. Well, Tom Frame, some people might accuse you of introducing God into these arguments because you are a priest. You have a vested interest in thinking theologically, and they might accuse you of cranking up a natural law argument to cover really a moral and theological argument.
Look, John, to be honest, I think you'll find all of those kind of arguments in my book, whether stated and made plain or somewhere lurking in the shadows. I'm, like I suppose all of the listeners, a creature of a whole lot of environments. I belong to a number of different communities which have been operative in forming the ideas that I have and my ethical approach to life. I was an unintended child. My mother gave birth to me. I grew up in the circumstances that I did of a father whose life, whole life seemed to reject the notion of God, but he took me to Sunday school. And I've always gone through life believing there was a God, believing that God was relating to me, sometimes through the circumstances in which I found myself, and that the struggle to understand that God, to respond to that God, also influences what I've tried to be as a parent and the kind of person I try to be in the community that I now lead. And it's a community in which people say, you know, what should we make of infertility? What about IVF? What about donor sperm? What about all of these kind of questions? And I've tried to lay out, if you like, a few considerations that really bring us to the heart of it, which is the concern for children, and that we be concerned about, if you like, what nature might seem to dictate.
Well, it's the question there of nature dictating. I mean, you say at one point, it is unnatural and presently impossible for a homosexual couple to have children by any natural process to whom both partners are biologically related. Now, it's the use of the word unnatural that has people saying, hang on, what you're saying is not that it's unnatural, but it's against the law of God. Are you substituting one argument for another? A bit of sleight of hand going on here. Because if technology can give us the capacity to do it, then what was unnatural in one generation becomes natural for another. I mean, nature is not as immutable as all that.
No, it isn't. And I suppose there's a number of things in our society that we can do that we decide not to do because we see in nature something that we think ought to be there or something that is intentional. I'd almost go as far as saying something that is designed. And I do believe, and I suppose I'm working it back into the argument, I do believe in the complementary care given by men and women, and therefore that it is presently required or necessary in nature for children to be brought about by that means, we ought not to change that.
Not to change it forever, or, I mean, again, it's this question of mutable, immutable, you know. What ultimately is immutable here?
Look, John, all I can speak of is from my experience in the world that I'm living in now, and I just don't believe that this is a good thing for us to be doing, that we still require sperm and an egg, and that in as much as that's how human beings have always been brought into being, I'm really struggling to see at least to imagine all of the unintended consequences, all the other ways we would affect life if we would head in a direction to at least play around with those building blocks of life. Now, it may be that I'm just simply afraid. It may be that I lack imagination. It may be that this is simply unnecessary anxiety. But at this stage, I'm just very, very wary of doing anything that would create a situation where children just don't have a mother and a father. It's going to certainly, John, be more complicated.
And we are beginning to see emerging the tips, the evidence of the concerns you raise, particularly in areas that people are beginning to call commercial surrogacy, and also in the areas of prolonging women's reproductive capacity until they're of an age. Like we've had the stories last year about the sort of 60-year-old Italian grandmother who gave birth. These go to the area of both the commodification of kids and really the sense of lack of responsibility when the commodification leads us to actually seeing kids as almost toys, that a 60-year-old should think that they can be a competent parent in giving birth without knowing that they're capacity to deliver is going to be both foreshortened and somewhat weakened by just the physical decline.
No, that's right. And one of the things we know about surrogacy, and one of the things that troubled me when I was part of a hospital ethics committee with oversight of a fertility clinic, was that women find being a surrogate really, really difficult, and they don't want to line up a second time around. There was one particular case study of a woman who spoke of her experience and said to give up this child after 9 months and give it to someone I knew, and then to see the child grow up. That was extraordinarily difficult for her. And she said, if I knew that I would have felt this way, then I wouldn't have done that. And there have been a number of cases where, and it's almost impossible to get informed consent because you can't tell people, or you can't have people imagine how they will feel on an experience they've never had before, and one with all sorts of consequences they've never have imagined.
So it's damaging for both the biological parents and the purchasing parents, and damaging for the child. So you've got almost sort of five people who are potentially injured by this situation.
Well, they can be. And when it comes to, say, people having children when they're much older, I know already in the mid-40s that there are some things physically that I just can't do anymore, and that we do, if we're wanting to have parents in our 60s and 70s, open up the prospect that of our own demise. This is obviously for men more so than for women, and that the child will never know the father to whom, you know, it reasonably could look to for care and nurture. Now, we know that men get killed and children don't have fathers, but certainly to create a situation where, say, the case of the Romanian grandmother, well, she wasn't a grandmother, first-time mother, I think, at 67, and people were concerned about this because it was very likely that the child wouldn't get to 18 before its mother may have died and then becomes a burden on the state. So there were all those kind of issues as well, quite apart from just the physical demands of children, and that's why, I suppose, being grandparent, you can have them for as long as you're able, and then some people then are able to hand them back.
You finally end with a couple of scenarios which you could satirise, but you don't. I mean, one of your headings is retailing reproduction, and this is assembly line kids we're talking about here. You know, choose your delight along the line. For all its sci-fi overtones, it is creeping close, uncomfortably close, as you indicate, to reality.
Look, yes, that's right, John. If you can find the money to go to California, you can go there and you can quite simply look at a catalogue which will have donors of both sperm and eggs. You can choose someone that you like. And there's even, I see on the internet, there's a number of famous people who have made their sperm and eggs available at a premium rate. They're not willing to tell you who they are until you've kind of signed up. So that if you want, you know, George Clooney sperm or something like that, I'm not saying that he's donated, but someone famous like that, then for a premium, that's then available. And it is the case, this is not designer children. This is, you know, not being content with the kind of child that may have come from you and the person you love, and a child brought into the loving relationship you've established. That's something else. And I have to say that that's a world that's coming nearer. If human beings are going to want to do that now, then 20, 30, 40 years' time, who knows what attitudes will change, who knows what people will think, and who knows what children will have to endure.
It's a horrid parody of what in theology one ridicules as the prosperity gospel, isn't it? It's a sort of secularized, horrific parody of that in a way. That yes, it can all come to me.
That's right. And there's no surprise, John. There's no surprise. In other words, that, you know, this is the kind of child I want. I want to determine its gender. I want to turn some of its characteristics, its intellect. Will it be like me? I mean, one of the things that we have at the moment is just endless mystery and surprise. Look, we're mysteries to ourselves. Our children surprise us. And that actually gives a lot of life, a lot of interest. To get rid of that by trying to predict things, to get the kind of child that we want, I actually think that's going to impoverish life and potentially even make it boring.
Tom Frame, A Cautionary Tale, Children on Demand, The Ethics of Defying Nature. Thanks for joining us on Sunday night.
My pleasure. Thanks, John.
And let's finish with REM, and you've got to tell us why you chose Losing My Religion.
Well, I have to say that I'm working on a book with just that title at the moment, Losing My Religion, Unbelief in Australia, and I'm bringing the book out for the 150th anniversary of the publication of Origin of Species by Charles Darwin, which some people say was more responsible than any other publication for the loss of religion. So I want to look at why it is we're now finding belief very difficult in this country.
Tom Frame, something to look forward to. Thank you very much for joining us on Sunday night.
Thanks, John.
It's bigger than you, and you are not me. The lengths that I will go to, the distance.
was just a dream. That was just a dream. That